welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at another Hitchcock classic, Spellbound. Returning on the show today to talk about Spellbound is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this is about the third or fourth time I've seen this movie, and I was wondering what your thoughts. Do you feel that this is underrated? Because when you think of Hitchcock, there are other films that come out, like even the Hitchcock in the 40s, you would probably say something like Rebecca or Rope or another Bergman film, Notorious, before you would say this film or even Shadow of a Doubt. Do you feel that this film is sort of underseen in his filmography?
I do. A lot of people haven't seen this movie. You know, it's got sort of a strange topic, you know, in it. It's a strange kind of movie, even for Hitchcock, but it doesn't have the same feel as a Notorious or Rear Window.
Yeah, and what's so strange about it, it has the typical Hitchcock regulars. It's got Ingrid Bergman. You got Gregory Peck, in which was one of his very first film roles. You got Leo G. Carroll. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say a lot about his character because he plays a big part in this movie, but I think he's been in like seven Hitchcock movies.
Yeah, he always plays sort of a background character, like the senator in Shadow of a Doubt, or the
Strangers on a Train.
And Strangers on a Train. You're right. Yeah. And he's also in, you're right, he's the professor in North by Northwest. Mm-hmm. He's the cousin who gives a job to Cary Grant in Suspicion. It's always kind of nice to see
always
him pop up.
Always kind of in the background.
Yeah. Always in the background.
He does have one of my favorite lines in Strangers on a Train. It's when after Bruno makes that scene when he chokes the woman and it causes a big scene, he goes, "Oh, imagine what the media says about this. Next thing you know, they're saying we're having orgies."
Yep, that's a great line from that movie.
You know what's interesting? I thought about this movie, especially for its time period. It took a serious look at psychology in movies. It's like it discusses it. It tells you like what the guilt complex is. It really dives into that. Where especially 1940s, I mean, it seemed like a lot of movies would be afraid to do that because it would like bore the audience or just be too complicated for them. But it's like it's telling you a lot about this, and I think for that time period, it's pretty interesting because I don't think a lot of movies at that time did that. Or if they did talk about psychology, it'd be like The Evil Therapist, or you know, something make it very soapy or something.
This is this shows how much David O. Selznick was inserting his own will into the movie because he was in analysis, so he wanted a movie that went into that subject. So he kind of forced it on Hitchcock. Hitchcock wasn't really interested in that as the topic, but Selznick insisted on it and even had his psychiatrist, you know, credited in the beginning as, you know, being an advisor.
I did read about that. This does kind of highlight that relationship they had with each other during the 40s. You know, he basically said he wanted to have a movie due on psychology, and if even Hitchcock did, like, was Hitchcock not at all interested in this story?
He wasn't interested. Well, he and Selznick were just not the same kind of guy. You know, mm-hmm. Selznick was very self-involved and very manic. He would take amphetamines and stay up and work everybody to death and just very type A, very manic. And Hitchcock mm-hmm. was this, you know, British country gentleman. You know, you go to work, you do your work, you go home. You have dinner with your family and you have a nice glass of wine. So temperamentally, they were not on the same page at all. And Selznick tried to sort of force his will on Hitchcock. And there are stories from when he would show up on the set, all work would stop. Hitchcock really? Just refused to, you know, play his game. So they didn't get along at all. And I think we talked when we were talking about Rear Window, how, you know, he made the villain look just like Selznick.
And even in Rope, the guy that they kill, his name is David.
So, oh, that's right.
Yeah, so just a little bit of there. A fantasy, like, hey, wouldn't we all want to strangle David sometime?
David Selznick, yes.
And it's interesting, this is a little bit way off topic, but you talked about how a lot of the producers would, you know, do that where they're taking amphetamines and staying up 20 hours a day. Very similar to one of my all-time idols is Robert Evans, movie producer, and even his audiobook, he said, like, you know, I work 20 hours a day. If it gets the film work, if it gets the film done, you know, mm-hmm. something like that.
I'm sure it gets a lot done.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Do you feel that talking about the psychology of the film, they do a lot of discussing in the film. They tell you what a guilt complex is. They tell, you know, when she's trying to dive at what's really Gregory Peck's problem, she gives you, because she's a therapist, she gives him all of these explanations, you know. Well, this is because of this in your childhood, or this or that. Do you feel that it gets a bit too expositional, where it's just like, you know, they're telling too much instead of showing?
I think it's a little heavy-handed. It's not as bad as the ending scene in Psycho where they you know, all of a sudden it drops out of a movie and you're listening to people explain the movie to you, which is the only flaw, the big flaw in that movie. But yeah, this one, it does go into a lot of those details, but I think you're onto something when you mentioned that this was not something people talked about. So maybe it was really interesting at the time that, wow, I can't believe people are detailing these things and they'd never heard about guilt complexes before. So it might have played better the first time,
yeah,
you know, in the 40s.
Yeah, actually bring up a really good point, because I can imagine for the modern audience of the 40s who have never, read into psychology or seen like a mainstream movie discuss that, I can imagine this would be fascinating to them. I bet you, granted, they would play amateur psychologists to everybody they met, like, well, I wonder if he has the guilt complex, like in Spellbound or
right,
something.
Right.
You know? And, one thing I did want to bring up. Now, when everybody talks about Alfred Hitchcock in music, probably the name everybody will bring up is Bernard Herrmann. And so this was about a decade before they started working together. But this is an award-winning score by Miklos Rozsa, who was also probably every bit as accoladed and well-received, respected as Bernard Herrmann. And it's a very good score. It's won an Academy Award. What I find interesting was kind of the use of the theremin, which, if people don't know, it's you get your hands to it, it makes a different vibration. It's probably most noted, like a lot of 50s sci-fi movies,
yes,
whenever the UFO
the
would hover, you know. But they use this one when he's having the flashback to the murder or something. And, you know, it's cool use of experimental music. And I always just kind of like that when it's not just traditional orchestral music. It's something they go a little bit different, unique.
Gets a great mood across, too. Mm-hmm. You know something's wrong. Even if it's not an alien landing, you know that there is something wrong. It's a great signal.
Yeah, and what it also does really well is it makes you, it leaves you with a lot of uncertainty, because whenever that thing's, when the theremin's going on, we see Gregory Peck's face, you know, get distorted. You're wondering, you probably think he might be the killer. He probably did kill the person.
Yeah, it adds that ominousness too, where it does make you wonder about whether he's a good guy or a bad guy.
And then moving on to the lead actress in the movie is Ingrid Bergman. And it was interesting, we're going to talk about this a lot more in Notorious, but it's very polar opposite characters in these movies, where, you know, Notorious, everybody in the movie Notorious likes to make note that, well, we all know about her kind of character. You know, they like to basically say she likes to party, she's a bit promiscuous, all that kind of stuff. Everybody likes to say that towards her and even say it to her face. This one, she looks like she's the exact opposite. She's not outgoing. She doesn't like to party. Looks like she's more wrapped up in her work and doesn't have time for anything else. And she's even like wearing the glasses and everything to make her look like, you know, frumpy or whatever.
I'm glad you mentioned the glasses, because I was just going to say that, because this is one of those characters that Hitchcock uses where, you know, she starts off very buttoned up and wearing the glasses, and then she falls in love and the glasses come off and she relaxes. Mm-hmm. He loves to do that thing with the glasses.
Mm-hmm. It is one of the most annoying cliches in movies, when they're trying to make somebody look like less unattractive. Mm-hmm. They just put glasses on them. Like, that'll work. That'll make them. Coming up recent films was Wonder Woman, when they're trying to dress her up to make her look more incognito, and they just put glasses on her. Chris Pine's assistant, like, well, that's not like, that's just going to make her like not look like the most beautiful woman you've ever seen.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Spellbound's interesting, because this was where they started cueing the audience to look for Hitchcock's cameo.
Oh, really?
And this is one that, in all the ads, they would say, to look for it. And so everybody started looking for it. And in this movie, he's, getting on an elevator.
Yeah.
So after this movie, then everybody started looking for the cameos. But this was the one where they actually made a point of mentioning the fact that he had one and to look for it.
Interesting, because I know, even he did that, way back when he was in Britain, he would still do that. But this was sort of, at the time, look for it.
Yes, yes.
So we were talking a little bit about Leo G. Carroll. What's interesting in this movie is, you talk about, he's always somebody in the background. But even when he's the background character, he's a good guy. You know, he's the good guy. He's the good senator in Strangers on a Train. I'm completely blanking, but your other films.
Yeah, in Suspicion, he plays the cousin who gives Cary Grant a job and ends up being robbed by him. Yeah,
he's the good guy.
He's the good guy.
He's one of the good spies, I believe, in North by Northwest. Mm-hmm. So he's always a good guy. This movie, it's a bit, spoiler alert, it's a bit different, because they, he's a bad guy. He's the guy that really killed it, and he framed it on Gregory Peck. So it's an interesting change of character for him. It's sort of bringing him into sort of the spotlight where he's always been in the background.
Up until the last moment, though, you think he's the same good guy you've seen in all the other movies, which is the genius of using him.
Yeah, definitely, because you don't even think about it, really, that he's the bad guy until he makes that last little point. Like, I only knew him slightly.
Yes.
And then just to hammer that point, like, more, they have her, like, thinking in her mind, I only knew
him slightly.
You know. And so I almost forgot to bring up Gregory Peck a little bit. It was interesting. So this was 1945, and I believe this was probably, it was just sort of the breakout role for him, because I know he only did like one or two other films before this.
Leo G. Carroll?
No, Gregory Peck.
Oh, well, Gregory Peck, his claim to fame is, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. I don't know that any movie has made him more famous than that one. I mean, when he, you know, I think that's the movie he's associated with.
Yeah, but I meant like, as far as a movie star, it was just like his first big hit.
I'm not sure when To Kill a Mockingbird came out.
That was the 60s.
Okay. Then this would have been, you know, I don't know if this is a movie that would have been very good for him in terms of publicity, but this is one of the one times that Hitchcock used somebody who was sort of a movie star like that. He did that with Montgomery Clift and I Confess, too. You have this one movie that he did with this, because he worked with everybody. But if you really liked them, he used them over and over, like Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart and Ingrid Bergman,
Grace Kelly,
yeah. Tippi Hedren.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that wasn't quite the best relationship.
No, and I don't know if any of his relationships. I think they all had their issues.
Yeah, he had his issues. And one thing I also and actually talk about the chemistry. I guess I was reading that. It's interesting. I know it sounds a bit like tabloid gossip. I apologize for that, but I guess Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck were attached at that time. They were in a relationship together during the filming of this movie.
I think they look like a couple. They make a great couple. It comes across in the movie, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, and I guess we can't, probably one, what's probably I'd say is the most notable thing about this movie, which I think is really interesting, is the dream sequence by Salvador Dali. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's the very famous surrealist painter, like think that painting with all the clocks melting. And I think that sequence is really good. It fits perfectly for him. It also helps fit the disturbed mind of Gregory Peck's character. And it's just really, really creative, just like the, you know, the gambling hall, the man with no face, you know, all the eyes everywhere, the hawk chasing him down that roll of steps. It's like great. It's like something out of like Dr. Caligari or German Expressionist.
Yeah, it's a cool sequence. But actually, Hitchcock had nothing to do with it because he didn't want Dali. This was Selznick's idea, and he insisted. So they shot it, but it's not done by Hitchcock. And apparently there are more publicity stills that, you know, of scenes or shots that didn't make it into the final sequence. There's one of Ingrid Bergman as Diana, you know, as a Grecian goddess. So I think it's a really cool sequence.
You're interesting you said that he didn't have anything to do with it, because I was watching the film again. And I was like, man, this feels really cut. I would like to see just a couple more minutes of this because it looks really good. But the studio's cut. I was like, they probably, you know, Hitchcock wanted, I was saying to myself, well, Hitchcock probably wanted it a lot. And the studio said, you're going too far. But that's interesting that you said he didn't want anything to do with it at all.
He did it. Yeah. So somebody else did that part of it and then they inserted it. I show that in my world cinema class, that sequence, because when I talk about Dali, I want to show them, by the way, here's a little sequence of something you never knew Dali did in this little-known Hitchcock movie. And it's really kind of cool and interesting. And you can see how it looks like the melting watches and everything. Mm-hmm. You know it's Dali. I mean, definitely. As soon as you see it, you know it's Dali. And then I make them watch an Andalusian dog, which is extremely bizarre and very Dali.
And talking a little bit about Dali, what other films did he do? I know didn't he do stuff with Louis Buñuel?
Yes, The Andalusian Dog.
That's Louis Buñuel?
Yeah, okay. Very, very weird movie. But you know, it was made in the 20s and it was intended to be avant-garde. And when he and Buñuel did it, they weren't sure how it was going to be received. So when they showed it for the first time, they put rocks in their pockets just in case. You know, everybody really objected. And the strange thing about the movie is it really doesn't matter when you start it, because nothing is meant to follow. It's meant to be surreal and, you know, not a real plot. So I've actually seen it in places like modern art museums where they just put it on an endless loop. It doesn't matter when you come in on the movie.
Interesting. And what about the other Buñuel film, Un Chien Andalou, the one where they're cutting the eyes open?
That's an Andalusian dog. That's Un Chien Andalou.
Oh, I spelled it wrong?
No, no, you said it in Spanish.
Oh, okay. That's how I knew it.
Or in French, maybe. Yeah, I think that's French.
Okay, so that was the one. All
right. Yeah, and there's no dogs in it, nor is it set in Andalusia. but Buñuel went on to do other things, you know, the L'Âge d'Or and other really artistic movies.
Yeah, the two films I had to watch in a film class of his were, let's see, was The Phantom of Liberty and That Obscure Object of Desire.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, maybe not quite for me. Didn't hate it as much as like Dogville. I know I keep bringing that up, but
that's the high water mark.
That's the high water. It wasn't irritating. I'm just like, okay, you're correct. It's just a realist. Okay.
But, yeah, he has a very definite look and feel to his movies.
And so we've been talking a lot about how much David O. Selznick really pushed this movie and how it almost felt like Hitchcock didn't even want to do this. So I know just a couple years later he left RKO. You know, was this pretty much the tipping point for him?
Oh yeah, he couldn't wait to stop working with Selznick. He did his contract, and then he was really glad to be done with that relationship.
You know, it was interesting because on TCM right now, they're doing like a 50 years of Hitchcock thing every Wednesday and Friday this month, and they always talk about the movies beforehand. And last week when they were talking about Rebecca, he actually says Hitchcock has almost disavowed that movie, like he wants nothing to do with it, which is strange because that won him Best Picture, his only Best Picture. And it's just, and that's because that's a David O. Selznick that kind of pushed that. But I just find that interesting, like the movie that probably is his most accoladed in America as far as awards go, and he doesn't want anything to do with it.
Rebecca's sort of not very Hitchcock, though, I don't think. There's not a lot about that movie that strikes me as being Hitchcock. It's Hitchcock trying to make a Gone with the Wind movie for David O. Selznick, and that's probably why he doesn't like it.
Yeah, it has some elements, though, I think, sort of the mystery around what, you know, Rebecca and the twist that he wasn't obsessively in love with her, that he hated her guts, and just the obsession character of Judith Anderson. There's stuff in there, but I do agree, it's not the one you think of the most. It's probably his most Hollywoodish.
Yeah, and I actually like Suspicion a lot better than Rebecca in terms of Joan Fontaine. Story's better. It's much more Hitchcock.
Suspicion's all right. What always throws me off is that ending when, you know, oh, I wasn't trying to kill you, honey. It's just all a big misunderstanding. We're going to be okay now, aren't we? That always just got me. I'm just like, I don't like the movie now because of that ending.
Now, you know, Hitchcock didn't want to end it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wanted to end it like the book. And they wouldn't let him because people couldn't deal with the idea of Cary Grant being a bad guy.
No, that's a good point.
See, today, you could probably do that.
Definitely.
But back in the day when they had the stars, you know, when they carefully managed their
studio system and everything. Yeah. And do you think it might have been because of the Hays Code, or did the Hays Code have little to do with it?
That too, because, you know, you couldn't show somebody getting away with a crime.
Yeah. Okay. And let's see, what else did I write? Oh, I forgot. Interestingly, this was based on a book called The House of Dr. Edwards by Hilary St. George Saunders and John Palmer. So anything to discuss about that? I've never read the book. Have you?
I have found it for free online as a PDF, and I've included it in my class. And if anybody wants to read it, I'll find the link for you and send it to you.
So keeping up a little bit of a discussion with Hitchcock and books, have you read any kind of... I did read the book Vertigo was based on, but have you read any other stuff of his?
I have Frenzy. I have the short story that Rear Window was based upon. Of course, Daphne du Maurier, you know, with the birds and with Rebecca. And even, I think, Jamaica Inn. I think she might have written one of those.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, Gregory Peck did do another movie with Hitchcock. He did The Paradine Case, which he absolutely loathed. And a reporter asked him once which of his pictures he would most like to burn, and he said The Paradine Case.
Gregory Peck?
Yeah.
It's interesting, because I know he hated Moby Dick. I thought that was the one he hated the most. And then other films. I know Ingrid Bergman, didn't she do another film with Hitchcock called
Under Capricorn? Yeah, again, not very Hitchcock at all. It's this period piece with, you know, costumes and everything, very, very not Hitchcock. Because he always seems to do like an ordinary person, and then something really bizarre happens to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like even Rebecca has a little bit of costume drama and everything in that too. So
it does.
And one thing I also wanted to note about going back to Spellbound, one thing I also really wanted to notice about it, talk about is it's black and white, but it was interesting the very end shot when Dr. Murchison. Spoiler alert again, Dr. Murchison shoots himself, mm-hmm. get a brief little flash of like gunfire. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, red, yellow or
it's red.
Orangish or whatever. And that's just really interesting that he chose to use that little bit of color in a black and white movie.
And I always tell my students when I've shown that in the class, don't blink or you'll miss it.
Definitely, yeah, like literally.
And we have actually had the movie end and they'd be like, was that it? Like, I'm not sure I really saw it. Of course, that angle's really bizarre because the way the gun turns around is actually impossible,
yeah.
You know, with your hand holding it. But it's it looks cool. By the way, the scene where they're skiing on mattresses with gypsum and cornflake snow. And I absolutely love the periodness of that.
That is fantastic.
They're, you know, skiing in a suit, you know.
Yeah. So was it on like a fake ski set? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, a lot of those movies from the 40s look really fake whenever they're doing a mm-hmm. car chase or something. I think that's actually part of the charm.
And like, you know, when they're riding in the car, the thing is there's always a screen in the background.
Yes.
And you can tell that they're just riding some prop set and there's like a, you know, screen in the back. So we've talked a lot about how this film is sort of underseen, underrated. Not a lot of people know this movie. So we could talk a little bit about other underappreciated Hitchcock films. One film I want to point out that you can almost say it's not a Hitchcock film because the way it kind of plays out is called The Wrong Man.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that with Henry Fonda. And it's based on a true story, which Hitchcock I don't think has ever done. And in parts of it, you could say it's Hitchcock guy wrongly accused of a crime he did not commit, has to try to prove his innocence. That's very Hitchcockian. But it's done in a very kind of procedural way where it's like, and this happened, and this happened, and approximately this time this happened. And it's a very interesting film. Like, even what's interesting also really about that movie is we get our Hitchcock cameo at the very beginning, and mm-hmm. he basically says, this was not one of my other movies, you know. This is very different. Just, I'm going to prepare you for this. It was based on a true story. So if you're trying to start out in Hitchcock, definitely don't watch that because you're going to get a different expectation, but once you've kind of seen a lot of his movies, watch that because you're going to it's something a lot different, but still very good.
And Henry Fonda and Vera Miles, mm-hmm. both of them absolutely fantastic. And score by Bernard Herrmann. And if you look at some of the scene, look at the scene where Henry Fonda is arrested and they put him in the car. That is actually, that was the inspiration. That whole shot, all those shots in the car, was the inspiration for what Scorsese did with Taxi Driver. The looking in the rearview mirror and the...
Wow.
Yeah, that, and, you know, with the music of Bernard Herrmann going with it. Yeah, it's very evocative.
And so, besides The Wrong Man, any other films?
I would say Lifeboat.
Yeah, that's a really
good one. Lifeboat's also another one of those movies that's sort of, you know, you wouldn't think it would really be very Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a war movie.
It's just sort of a survival movie, too. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of, we should talk about Lifeboat sometime.
We can definitely do that.
Yeah, that's one of those ones also that is not, you know, in collections. You know, you get mm-hmm. you buy a collection, you get Vertigo and Rear Window and Rope. That one is always, you have to buy separately.
Definitely. And what other ones I'm trying to think of? Do you think Shadow of a Doubt counts as underrated? Because he's gone on record saying that's his all-time favorite movie he's done.
Shadow of a Doubt, I think, is very well known because it's been done so many times as a radio play. I think everybody kind of knows about that one. But I don't think that one is watched as much as some mm-hmm. of the other ones.
Okay, I got one for you. The Lady Vanishes.
Love that
one. That's a great one.
I like to compare that one with Flight Plan because Flight Plan basically redoes The Lady Jodie Vanishes.
Foster, yeah.
Right down to the, mm-hmm. you know, the thing on the window.
And even, I would probably say... a lot of people, for his underrated stuff you probably haven't seen, any of the stuff he's done in Britain, like the original Man Who Knew Too Much,
mm-hmm.
The 39 Steps, which is probably his first huge hit film, or even, I have this one I haven't seen, but The Lodger, which is a silent movie, mm-hmm. which some people say that's like the first true Hitchcockian movie.
Yeah, you know, I might say something like To Catch a Thief, because I think everybody has seen Rear Window, and I think everybody's seen Dial M for Murder, but To Catch a Thief is one of those, not quite as well known, and Frenzy too, and of course Family Plot, which I think was just a terrible movie.
What about Frenzy? Because I know that was like his second to last film, and he came back to Britain to do that one.
The thing about Frenzy that stands out to me is that it's the only movie I've seen him do where he actually shows some nudity, and it's disturbing. Because, you know, he hadn't done that. So it seemed like a crass inclusion. But otherwise, I think that movie's terrific.
Did it feel like he was like, because this was the 70s, so it's the modern race system's like, I'm going to make an R-rated movie before I go out, by God.
Right. And he always liked to try things. So he might have decided this was the time to bring that out and see how people reacted to it.
I'll have to check that out. No, that one's going to be playing pretty soon on the 50 Years of Hitchcock Marathon, so I'll have to keep an eye out for that. Okay, so getting closely to my questions here. Anything that I forgot to talk about that you want to bring up now?
This movie was one of the scriptwriters with Ben Hecht. I just wanted to mention he wrote so many things and for everybody. But he certainly did a lot of stuff for Hitchcock, including Lifeboat, Paradigm Case, Rope, Foreign Correspondent, Strangers on a Train, Notorious, and Spellbound. So he did a lot of writing. And he was a script doctor. You know, they would bring him in to fix things up that weren't working out. So he had involvement in a lot of really famous movies.
Yeah. I remember looking at that. I was like, wow, this guy's done. I've seen a heck of a lot of films, and you don't know his name a lot. Okay, so the last question I have is, you bring this film into your class?
Spellbound. I use it in my world cinema class because it has that Dali sequence, and then I can show that, so that people have seen one other thing by Dali before they go down the dark and bizarre world of An Andalusian Dog. And then I show some clips of from Midnight in Paris, where Owen Wilson meets Dali and Louis Buñuel and Man Ray. That's kind of a cool scene. And then I actually show a clip from What's My Line, which is this TV show.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd have people come on. You had to guess what they did for a living. And they had Salvador Dali on. And of course, all he says is yes and no. But you get a real sense of him just because of the way he carries himself. So I like to show that and then the scene from Midnight in Paris so people can see, okay, this is what the real guy was like. And this is how he is depicted when somebody tries to be Dali.
Go ahead.
As interesting as Adrian Brody is as Dali, he's really over the top. And Dali himself was not that flamboyant. He was very elegant, but you could tell he was a little odd.
You can definitely tell with the paintings too.
and the mustache.
And what about your Hitchcock class? Do you bring this into that or?
Oh yes, this is one of the ones I'm doing an online class, all online, and for Hitchcock. So this is one of the movies that's in there. I put as many in there as I could, but I left out all the ones that I think are kind of touched briefly on sort of lesser movies. Like, we don't do Jamaica Inn or Sabotage.
Yeah, Jamaica Inn, I know a lot of people say that's his worst movie.
It is pretty bad.
Okay.
I guess they can't all be good, right?
Yeah, you go. Every director's got a stinker every now and then. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about the Alfred Hitchcock film Spellbound. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhead, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me on.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying women make the best psychoanalysts until they fall in love. After that, they make the best patients.